This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State. For those who listen, for those who are willing to listen.
The Palestinian political world has a story about us. But the foundation of the story is that we are dislodgeable. We are removable. We are of a type, and the type changes. Sometimes we're imperialist, sometimes we're colonialist, sometimes we're crusaders, in Hamas's more Islamic language. We are a thing that is, at its depth, at its core, artificial, and therefore not sustainable, and therefore doomed to fail, and therefore all peace, all acceptance of Israel is a kind of collaboration. It is a violation of the basic faith that there is a just God overseeing a just arc to history, and so it is also an act of heresy. There are different discourses that have different ways of saying that and different extents, and some are secularized and some are much more religious. But nevertheless, that is the story of the Palestinians about us.
Yes, I think if we can manage to deliver, and it still is an if, of course, but if we can manage to deliver in the amount of time remaining to us that death blow to the Hamas political authority in Gaza, again, not to the Hamas idea, no, that's out there, you can't kill an idea, but that's okay. We're trying to destroy a political authority, and that is doable by military power, and there are examples of it in recent history. If we can do that, then yes, we certainly will have the Gulfies on our side in terms of what happens next, and I suspect that one way or another it'll be an arrangement including Gulf finance, I suspect also including the Ramallah Palestinian Authority in some form or another, and I sincerely hope also including a local leadership. How exactly we'll get to that, what exactly we'll look like, we don't know yet, and I think nobody can say, but it all ultimately still does depend on us achieving the military goal against Hamas.
How has October the 7th challenged Israelis' own conceptions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Has the left anywhere left? What about day after planning? Has it seriously begun? And does peace lie with the Gulf states? Just how much do the Saudis and the UAE want Israel to win? Who in Palestinian society is someone Israel can actually deal peace with? Is there anyone? Is war from Lebanon inevitable? The Houthis, another Iranian proxy, bombing Western ships in the Suez Canal. How many fronts could this war open? And is the escalation so inevitable that Iran joins in directly? Russia in Syria, Iran's land bridge there. Why is it imperative that Israelis from both the north and the south return one day to their towns and their kibbutzim? Two of Israel's leading journalists and analysts on the Middle East join me here in London thanks to Elnet UK, a bipartisan, cross-party international organization who stand above politics, working to advance UK-Israel relations. We go deeper into the Middle East conflict and through the hardship to try and find a route to a better day. Chaviv Retigor is a senior analyst for the Times of Israel. He's covered the politics, foreign policy, education, and relationship Israel has with the Jewish diaspora for 20 years. And he served as Director of Communications for the Jewish Agency and taught at the best pre-military academies in Israel. He was a correspondent at the Jerusalem Post. And Jonathan Spire is Director of Research at the Middle East Forum and edits the Forum's journal, The Middle East Quarterly. He's reported from Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Turkey, Ukraine, and back home, including in Gaza and Judea and Samaria. Jonathan wrote Days of the Fall, a reporter's journey in the Syria and Iraq wars. So let's have some level from the guys before we start.
I am Chaviv Gul. I am from Israel. I work as a political journalist at the Times of Israel. We publish in five languages, including Persian, Arabic, and French, on top of Hebrew and English. And I like to take long walks on the beach. I enjoy a nice margarita. I don't actually. We're just taking sound levels, right?
That's a great introduction to the podcast. Okay. It reminds me of the Pina Colada song by Rupert Holmes there.
I don't know.
Getting caught in the rain.
Okay.
I was tired of my lady. Jonathan.
Yes.
Who are you?
Well, I'm Jonathan Spire, and I'm a journalist and Middle East analyst of some years standing. I'm based in Jerusalem. And I cover large parts of the Middle East, but mainly have an interest in Syria and Iraq and Lebanon. Those are the countries that I'm especially fascinated by and spend my time writing about and thinking about.
Khaviv Retigur and Jonathan Speier, welcome to Johnny Gould's Jewish State, the next stage of the Israel-Gaza war. We are 100 days plus into this war. Khaviv, can we talk first of all about where we think Israel is, the military successes, and perhaps some of the problems that have been encountered that need tackling?
If we're talking about the battlefield itself, the progress of the war in Gaza itself, leaving aside the vast numbers of the social question in Israel, the vast mobilization, the economic cost, the suffering of Gazans, the there's a lot to talk about, but strictly on the strategic military level, the war has gone extraordinarily well. The army encountered less resistance than it thought it would. It encountered that resistance, but it was able to disrupt it in ways that really showed. And incidentally, it has gotten better along the way. It has learned Hamas's tactics. Hamas tried multiple times to produce company-level attacks against Israeli forces, 50, 60 fighters. It had a lot of places where it had planned these kinds of engagements, and it has failed. That has been disrupted by Israeli forces. The IDF estimates 50 dead Hamas combatants to every single Israeli combatant dead. If we take that as a aspiration, a little bit optimistic of a number, then even if it's half that, it's still 25 to 1. And so the northern operation was relatively fast. Some of Hamas's central operational command had to flee to the south of Gaza, and the north has now shifted from the ground operation, from the taking of the land, to the difficult tunnel war, the counterinsurgency, you can call it what you will. In the south, the effort to actually take the territory itself above ground is still underway. It's going to go slower, it's going to be more targeted, and the forces there are fighting a much less, we'll call it, fewer airstrikes, much more focused on gun battles in the streets. But again, going well. The one major thing to know is that it will take a long, long time. It was always supposed to take a long time. Defense Minister Gallant said that, I think, in the first week of the war. So, successful. The fact that it has been that successful up until now, and the enemy has been unable to produce strategic surprises, doesn't mean it won't be able to. It is in the nature of enemies to produce strategic surprises in the battlefield. But nevertheless, better than we could have hoped for, strictly on the military dimension.
And of course, Jonathan, what is going to hold up and make this continuing battle harder is the prospect of attempting to rescue the hostages. And they are in awful conditions, depraved conditions. We're hearing stories from particularly women who've returned. We have a one-year-old baby there. God willing, he's still alive. They are using psychological weaponry to tell people that hostages are dead. We have no idea whether they are dead or not. So there is a vital subtext to the progress, the success, as Khabib said, of this war.
Yes, well, absolutely. I think that the strategy which Hamas and which its leader in Gaza, Sinwar, and the people around him are trying to use transparently, is that of trying to use the hostage issue to slow the advance of the IDF, believing that they'll be able to do that until such time as the diplomatic clock permitted Israel will run out. That's clearly what they're trying to do, and it will be up to Israel to creatively prevent them from doing so. I very much agree with what Khaviv, the characterization that Khaviv gave to the progress of the military front so far. I have myself reported from both northern and southern Gaza and can report back, so to speak, that certainly the impression I had of the feeling and morale among the fighting troops at the sharp end was very positive indeed. I think people are hugely committed to the goal and to the mission. So yes, in the southern Gaza specifically now, the issue of the hostages and the issue of the future survival, or as we hope, non-survival of the core Hamas leadership around Yahya Sinwar, let's say Sinwar himself, his brother Mohammed Sinwar, Mohammed Deif, Marwan Issa, and a few others. This is now going to come onto the agenda. And the 98th Airborne Division, the Airborne and Commando Formation, which is handling, a very large formation, by the way, now, which is handling the battle in the south, is going to have to start in the weeks ahead and months ahead grappling with those issues, how to get to the hostages without getting them killed, how to get to the Hamas leadership, you know, to know where they are, to find them, to eliminate them, and to begin to do what was done in a more straightforward way because of a different nature of the battlefield in the north, which is essentially to break the back of and dismantle the central nervous system of the Hamas political and military authority, which has controlled the Gaza Strip for the last 17 years.
Because, Khaviv, Israel contained, tolerated barrages of rockets, put the war off until the terrible pogrom of 7/10, and it's changed everything. Hamas must now be destroyed is the overriding consensus of almost the entire Israeli population. How do you think it's challenged Israel's conceptions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Has it put back the day of peace? Or has it focused the Gulf world, who are nominally on Israel's side, the UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, etc.?
There are many, many questions in that question. On October 7th, before October 7th, we believed that our massive power, firepower, just literal firepower, deterred Hamas, deterred all our enemies. And we did not understand that Hamas is a unique enemy, never faced before by any military in the history of warfare. A lot of militaries have faced guerrilla forces that attack and then hide behind civilians, irresponsible forces, forces with a strategy of drawing a standing army into civilian territories to force civilian casualties on them as a force multiplier. A lot of armies have faced other armies, other states that control an economy and a territory for long periods and can construct, can wield the entirety of an economy toward a war effort. No one has ever faced a guerrilla force with the irresponsibility of a guerrilla strategy that also controls and wields an entire territory, a population, an economy. And therefore, Hamas has been able to dig in under Gaza to an extent that is unparalleled in the history of such military conflicts, and has been able to do essentially to take our firepower, and instead of our firepower deterring them, transform our own firepower into the very thing that deterred us. We thought they were deterred when in fact we were deterred. We could not imagine over the course of probably the last 12 or 13 years, when the tunnel project has really been underway in a serious way, we could not imagine something that they would do to us that would force us to fight them in a way that would actually dislodge them from Gaza, because fighting them in a way that would dislodge them from Gaza because of how they had built Gaza since taking it over in 2007 would involve cutting through the civilian population and causing enormous civilian harm. And then they committed October 7th. And so there are two horrific atrocities by Hamas. The first was what they did to us. But the second is the longer one, and the one that has a far greater toll in human lives. And that is what they did to Gaza, which is to use guerrilla strategy with an entire polity, an entire area of this world, with a population that it controlled and an economy that it ruled. And it did nothing with this economy except build this method of placing the entire population between it and an Israel it was about to force to come after it. Where does that put us in terms of Israeli understanding of Palestinian politics and Israeli understanding of whether there is a peace available? The Israeli left, the part of Israeli society and Israeli politics that thinks that there is a two-state solution available, that there is on the other side in Palestinian politics a capacity to reciprocate an Israeli withdrawal with real peace, if there is such a capacity, a withdrawal becomes sensible. And if there isn't such a capacity, a withdrawal from the West Bank shrinks me down to 9 miles wide in the middle, with Hamas taking over the highlands that overlook all my cities. It becomes untenable. It becomes literally impossible. And so that Israeli left that sought that outcome was basically politically shattered in the Second Intifada, when at the height of the peace process, this is certainly how Israelis experienced it, at the height of the peace process in the year 2000, 140 suicide bombings hit Israeli towns, Israeli cities. I remember the year 2000. I remember my neighbors sending their kids to school on buses, city buses in Jerusalem, and putting each kid on a different bus so that if one blew up, they wouldn't lose all the kids. That shattered the Israeli left. The Israeli left hasn't won an election since. What happened on October 7th was that, first of all, we went farther down that. In other words, it's an extension of the lesson of the Second Intifada. They wouldn't just attack us from any territory we control. They would destroy their own people. They would rain on their own people a rain of fire, as we have to. They would become something we must remove as a threat from our border, no matter the cost from our perspective. But then they made sure the cost for the Palestinians is absolutely immense. They have a long vision. They have a long religious ideology, and they don't mind how many Gazans die along the way. And so there isn't really anyone left on the Israeli left. The people who were attacked on October 7, those kibbutzim, they were some of the last vestiges of the left that still believed in the capacity of Palestinian politics to reciprocate. And so there really, it is a decimation, it is a unification by making us feel so tremendously vulnerable where we had once felt powerful. Hamas has convinced itself that it has done some tremendous win for Islam and for the Palestinian cause. But our vulnerability is the source of our unity and our strength. And what it has done is unify us with a grim determination never to allow them to do that again. How do I withdraw? Imagine that I'm an Israeli left-winger who still wants a two-state solution. I literally don't know how to do it. And nobody can explain to me how to do it. So I think that on a generational scale, I think I'm still optimistic. I'm optimistic because they are forcing Israel to do the hard job, the awful job, the job with immense costs to Palestinians, obviously, but also to Israel. But they're forcing us to do that job of removing them from the equation. That itself, at the other side of this horrific time, opens up possibilities that are not available as long as they're still in power. But for that, but for the generation that we're going to go through now, before that happens, There's simply no capacity to move toward any kind of peace that I can discern.
Jonathan, of course, it doesn't just affect the Gazans on their side of the border. It affects the Israelis on the south and indeed the north of the border. Because as it stands, the jihadists are winning one aspect of the battle, which is they are dictating where Jews should live in their sovereign state. And until such time as Jewish Israelis are allowed to return to Kibbutz Be'eri rebuilt, Kibbutz Nahal Oz, Ofakim and Sderot, and indeed the cities of the north, the jihadists can claim some sort of progress. It's very important, isn't it, that for food security as well as the issues of Jews living wherever they must in the Gaza envelope, that peacetime security must return to a normalized Israel after the war.
Well, absolutely, yes. With regard to the issue of the other front, you're mentioning the north, you know, it's worth remembering that, at least in my estimation, Hamas and its Gaza enclave is one manifestation of a much broader manifestation that we've witnessed throughout the region over the last 10, 15, 20 years, which is the emergence of political forces, which are also military forces, which are both guerrilla and semi-regular. Hezbollah in Lebanon, of course, is a well-known additional example of the phenomenon. The Islamic State was an additional one. Jabhat al-Nusra and other forces in northern Syria are another example. So this experience of Islamist forces that then become de facto governing forces and that then build a military model combining irregular and regular capacities is a known phenomenon, which I think, to my estimation, at least, compounds the massive strategic intelligence analysis failure which brought October 7th to us, namely the notion which we were discussing earlier, which the Israeli, I'd say both the security establishment and the political leadership of Netanyahu subscribed to, which was the notion that we had both deterred this particular manifestation of the phenomenon, Hamas in Gaza, and we had also, and this is really, I think, the cardinal failure that we of imagination, ultimately, that we had incentivized them. In other words, there was a belief that we had both deterred Hamas, and also Hamas had become softened by the experience of power. Hamas enjoyed being the ruling elite in the Gaza Strip. They enjoyed the Qatari dollars arriving every month. And therefore, we'd brought them to a situation where they were now biddable, if I can put it that way. This was an enormous failure of, ultimately, of imagination, an enormous failure of conceptual thinking. And we paid the price for it. And all the mistakes that took place further down the food chain, so to speak, that made October 7th a possibility. I mean, the operational failures and then the tactical failures. All of these derive ultimately from that failure in thinking, which then led to wrong decisions being taken further down the line. So, yes, it was a terrible failure. It was not across the board. Many people who studied Islamist and jihadi movements were saying at the time, you're making a mistake. If you think these people have been turned into something soft and malleable, that's because you're failing to understand who they are and how they think. But those who were saying that were not listened to by the establishment, and we saw what has followed. Yes, absolutely. It is my estimation that now, in the time of response and retaliation to that, we have to look broadly, not only at Hamas in the south, but also at Hezbollah in the north. I said we have to draw the lessons of October 7th, not only vis-a-vis Gaza, but elsewhere too. And to me, the cardinal central lesson is that the notion of accepting the emergence of areas of de facto governance by Islamist and jihadi organizations on Israel's borders, and then taking a calculated risk in which we just try and have technological means of defense on the border to keep them out, this is not an acceptable risk. It is not an acceptable risk to our citizens, and it's not an acceptable risk to Israel's future. So that means destroying Hamas in Gaza. But it also means destroying the quasi state in southern Lebanon, or if not destroying it, at least pushing it back far enough to the north in Lebanon such that it can no longer constitute a danger. And yes, you mentioned the population. I was up in the northern border just a couple of weeks ago, 86,000 people. Israelis have left their homes, and you mentioned food security. Sure, by the way, interesting little factoid I picked up there. That's where most of Israel's egg production comes from, up there in the north. So the fact that we've cleared out 5 kilometers south of the border means a significant food issue for Israel looking down the line. So sure, we need to get those people back into their productive capacity close to the border. And to do that, we have to address the problem of the quasi-state to the north of the border in a way that is to their satisfaction. However, they're just not going to come back to their homes in the north if they don't feel they can be safe. And that means very decisive action, I think, also in the north. And just lastly to say that, you know, these phenomena we are facing in South Lebanon and in Gaza, these reflect a broader regional problem. It's the same Iran-backed Islamist militias that have taken control in Iraq. It's the same Islamist Iran-associated militias that have taken control of the capital and most of the coastline of Yemen. So right now, it's not only us. I think we need to see this in the dimension that it is the Western world and its allies in the Middle East, of whom we are one, who are facing a generational challenge right now. And it remains to be seen how we are going to rise to that challenge, if we're going to see it through.
Indeed. Grant Shapps, the Defense Secretary, announced the end of the post-war settlement, what he called the pre-war settlement, which I thought was an extraordinary but very welcome, tragically, thing to say from a very high-ranking Western cabinet minister. It's the sort of thing that all of us as journalists know on the ground and have known for 10 years, and most people who feel like they're the canary in the coal mine. But for someone to announce that to the general public was very important. What Jonathan said there, Chaviv, about dealing with the quasi-state in the north, that's 150,000 rockets that Israel is facing, which would put Israel's population inside bunkers underground. It could destroy Tel Aviv, Haifa, cause untold destruction. But of course, Israel would preempt that by destroying Beirut. This is the cataclysmic fear that many people have in trying to prosecute a war in the North?
I think that the basic problem is very obvious, and a solution to it is not at all obvious. The basic problem is, what if they are not deterred by our firepower? What if the capacity that we have to wreak destruction on Hezbollah and on anything Hezbollah is embedded in, because we have no choice but to remove Hezbollah's capacity to destroy Tel Aviv and Haifa, what if that capacity has until now not deterred them, but deterred us, exactly on the Hamas model? Hamas is an indigenous Sunni Palestinian political entity. But the Hamas we saw on October 7th, the Nukba force and its capabilities, those are Iranian. Those are things it took from Iran. It had, the fighters had satellite photographs and plans and a careful understanding of the delicate nature of the Israeli sensors on that extremely clever multi-billion shekel fence. And that is a capability given to Hamas, not by Hamas itself. And so Hezbollah is, in that sense, a part of one of the key things that Hamas borrowed was the very strategy itself of crossing the border in that way, taking Jewish villages and towns in that way, and taking hostages and killing in that way. We know, because Hezbollah has put out videos of it over the years, that Hezbollah's Redwan force, which is an order of magnitude more powerful than the Nukba force of Hamas, has been training to do exactly that in the north. In a sense, there are people who argue now that, in fact, Hamas ruined the surprise, because we are awake. We assume that all of the capabilities that Hezbollah has built, that Iran has built in through Hezbollah, for the sole purpose of using, none of those rockets are there not to be used, and therefore they are not deterred. And so the question you raise is a profound one. This may become genuinely catastrophic for Israel, for Lebanon. We may have to settle this by essentially being the last one standing. Now, I don't mean the civilian populations. Nobody has, I think, the capacity to literally remove the civilian populations. But I do mean the infrastructures, and I do mean huge cost to civilians on the Israeli side and on the Lebanese side. My sense, and Jonathan's a bigger expert on this than me, is that Hezbollah was built by Iran not for one of these piecemeal proxy wars. Hamas declared war now outside of the schedule that Iran needed. Incidentally, Hamas didn't tell Iran. Hamas didn't even tell Hamas's own political leadership. It was part of the astonishing compartmentalization that allowed them to escape detection by the Israeli intelligence services. Now we know they didn't escape detection, but the Israeli intelligence services literally didn't believe what they were seeing. But nevertheless, the compartmentalization helped that along, the fact that the political leadership wasn't leaking the things the Israelis were expecting to see in such an event helped the Israelis think that that wasn't what was happening. But that compartmentalization included the Iranians. And so the Hamas was an independent actor in that sense. It did exactly what Iran hoped it would do. It did it with capabilities Iran gave it. It is part of that Iranian alliance, but it didn't do it on Iran's schedule. Hezbollah does work for Iran directly. Iran built Hezbollah not to hit Israel on its own, but to serve as a deterrence to Israel and as a second front in the event of an Israel-Iran war. Iran doesn't want Hezbollah destroyed because it doesn't want Hezbollah wasted for that future Iran-Israel war. And so Hezbollah has to be more careful, doesn't want to see a cataclysmic war come to Lebanon, not because it cares about Lebanese lives. We know that it has a larger, longer religious vision that accounts for and allows for not just the loss of civilians, but using the loss of civilians as a strategic force multiplier. So far, Hezbollah has done all kinds of things to try to avoid massive escalation. It's not at all clear that it can avoid massive escalation. If the Israelis themselves, Hezbollah has had to have this low level of conflict between the Israelis and itself to show that it is caring about Gaza, that it is part of the resistance axis, as it calls it. If one of those missiles goes astray, if Israel itself, for reasons internal to Israel that we talked about before, right, Israel doesn't think they're deterred, therefore this is a problem that has to be solved. If Israel decides that it will treat the next missile attack as that escalation that triggers the war, that is the casus belli, then Hezbollah has a real problem, and it's going to wreak on Lebanon a destruction that is, there's nothing to be said about it. It is nothing but tragic and horrifying. An Israeli ground war against Hezbollah in South Lebanon will be far more costly to the Israeli forces. I have two brothers-in-law right now fighting in Gaza. Most Israeli families have someone, 360,000 reservists called up. There's nobody who doesn't know somebody. This is going to get very bad in the north. And it's not clear how we avoid that.
And a war on that cataclysmic level, Jonathan, will engage the USS Gerald Ford, which is supposed to be a deterrent. It will engage, presumably, Iran directly, Britain, Yemen, the European Union. It is very difficult to see how this can be deterred unless Israel attempts to try to deal with Iran itself in a targeted way, which it's done in trying to disrupt the land bridge over Syria, and also directly with political assassinations carried out both by the Israelis and the US.
Yeah, first of all, with regard to the land bridge over Syria, we should be clear on this. For all the achievements, and there are undoubted achievements of what we called the war between the wars. Now we know which war it was between, right? Now the war has begun. But what we used to call the war between the wars was full of tactical boldness and tactical successes against Aleppo Airport, against the Al-Kiswa base. I could give you, the list. But here's the thing. Actually, it didn't deter, and it did not disrupt the land bridge, because the land bridge is a reality. And we know the land bridge is a reality because even as we speak, Iraqi Shia and other Iran-associated, Iran-employed militia forces are moving across the land bridge. That is to say, we had many tactical achievements in the war between the wars. We are superior to the Iranians in most, almost all conventional military forms, but their strategy progressed even during that period. That's why Israel now, even as we, in terms of the time we're now discussing, is hitting Iranian targets also in Syria, also in Abu Kamal on the Iraq-Syria border and elsewhere. It's testimony to the extent that the land bridge as a strategic project was not profoundly disturbed by the war between wars. Thus far, with regard to the land bridge that you mentioned, with regard to the broader issue of the big conflict, the big war we're discussing, yeah, there are many, many places in pieces in motion right now. We've discussed Gaza, and we've discussed a little bit also Lebanon, Hezbollah against Israel on the Lebanese border. Let us not forget, especially sitting here in London, that there is a third front currently active of this war, of this very conflict, which is taking place between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea across the Bab al-Mandeb. And it is a process in which, once again, an Iran-associated militia political entity slash militia slash political party, the Houthis or Ansar Allah, are seeking to disrupt global shipping and seeking to hit at Israeli targets also, but also global commercial shipping as a gesture of support or as a tactic of support to the Hamas war effort in Gaza. So it's true that Iran did not, or it appears to be true that Iran did not want this October 7th to happen at the precise moment, this attack to happen at the precise moment. But I think it's also true when we say that the Iranian response has been limited. Yeah, it has been limited, but we shouldn't also exaggerate that. There are some; these fronts are pretty hot indeed. 170 Hezbollah fighters are dead since October 7th. That speaks to a very active front. I was speaking to a senior Israeli officer in the Defense Ministry, and I was struck by the extent to which he was upbeat, and justifiably so, I think, at the Israeli military performance in the north. Nasrallah didn't expect, you can be for sure, to lose 170 fighters for the achievement, in his eyes, of 9 IDF dead. Right? That's a very, very poor achievement from Hezbollah's point of view. He's hemorrhaging men right now. But what that tells us is this is a very active, volatile front where just a single move can put us into a whole different dimension. And the southern front is the same. It took a long while, I think, for that reason, for the Americans and the British as well, to hit back at the Houthis. So we're seeing that the Iranians are hitting back. Do we have to hit Iran itself? My own personal estimation is that if this thing does escalate, it's not going to remain only a war between proxies. The Iranians themselves, the Revolutionary Guards Corps, took responsibility for the launching of two ballistic missiles at the northern Iraqi Kurdish capital of Erbil, with four deaths, supposedly against a Mossad station. So the Iranians, bit by bit, are already a little bit entering the fray. The Iranians, we think, also have hit at least one ship themselves heading towards India, because we know the range where it happened. This was not fired from Yemen, it was fired from Iran itself, as the ship was heading towards port in India. It was, if I'm not mistaken, a car container ship linked to an Israeli shipping magnate called Idan Ofel. So the Iranians, bit by bit, are already entering this. Yes, undoubtedly, if the major war, which I suspect is inevitable, between the Iran-led regional alliance and Israel and its allies, is happening now, and we don't know if this is the time yet, but if it is happening now, it won't only involve Iranian proxies against Israel and its allies, it will involve Iran itself. We're still some steps away, of course, from that war definitely being on right now. We don't know if we're living through the opening steps of it or not, but if it does come, it will involve Iran, absolutely, as a player. They won't get to just sit back and send their dogs of war, so to speak, against their enemies.
Let me add to that the scenario you painted at the beginning, two questions ago, with, 50,000 missiles falling on Tel Aviv. That will be replicated in Tehran. In other words, as the Israelis lose what to lose, the scale for Iran of the damage will grow, and there'll be an interest in Israel for it to grow. So I second absolutely everything that Jonathan said, and just to say there is a very imaginable, dynamic, easy to game out. It is, at some point, it will be more likely than not likely, in which this escalates very, very quickly, and each side has an interest in hitting faster and harder and escalating faster in order to either deter the other side or, you know, see it through to the end as quickly as possible to minimize the damage of the damaging war. So we are looking at a potential, the Israelis can't allow these threats on their borders. That is going to escalate to a certain level. The Iranians don't want to lose the capacity to threaten Israel in those ways. That is going to escalate it further. Each side is going to make decisions. It is very easy to game out, as Jonathan said. At some point, it's going to be a runaway escalation that nobody's going to be able to stop. And if either, and it, there's a little bit of game theory psychology here. If either side thinks it's going to happen anyway, they have the interest of escalating faster. And so it's going to be something very dramatic also in Iran.
And we have to talk, gentlemen, as we have dotted around the Middle East, about Russia, who are in Syria, and they use Israel as a buffer so as not to take on Iran, the other competing imperial power in Syria. So there's a sort of de facto arrangement between Israel and Russia that allows Israel to attack Iranian positions. But if something goes wrong and an escalation gets out of control, then Russia is involved, isn't it? If its interests are directly assaulted. Gentlemen, Jonathan first, perhaps.
Yeah, so first of all, regarding Russia, I mean, the way I would characterize Russia's role in Syria is that it is a strategic partner of Iran. If we note the fact that the Assad regime, which was, of course, very much on the ropes just about a little less than a decade ago, has come through the civil war and the insurgency against it, that is equally down to Iranian capacities and Russian capacities. Capacities, by the way, which kind of complemented one another. Each one provided what the other one couldn't. The Iranians provided massive assistance on the ground in terms of ground fighters, and the Russians provided material and also diplomatic support. That Permanent Security Council seat they have, which of course is so useful in preventing effective international action against anybody they want to prevent it for. So they've complemented one another with regard to Syria. And I would say since the Ukraine invasion of 2022, it's become clear that this relationship has deepened because it's now a little bit more of a reciprocal relationship, because the Russians, who became short of armaments when they were dealing with this unexpectedly determined Ukrainian resistance, began to cast about for friends, and they found a friend in Tehran, and the Shahed 136 drones, which are good weapons against civilians, not so much against soldiers. The Russians don't mind that. They're happy to make war on civilians too, just like the Iranians are. These drones have proven very useful to be hurled in large numbers at Ukrainian cities, and the Iranians have been providing also ammunition and also rockets and missiles to the Russians. They're even creating a drone factory, we're told, on Russian soil. So there is a close relationship here. And the Russians have themselves provided the S-300 air defense system to the Iranians. So Russian patronage and friendship for Iran is a big help for Iran and a big complicating factor for anybody who might be thinking of hitting at Iran at any stage. Having said all that, everything which I at least have managed to pick up from sources and friends regarding the Russian stance on the current conflict, from what I've been given to understand at least, the deconfliction arrangement that Israel has with Russia in Syria remains in place. And I've even heard that the Russians have been acting as a persuasive factor to the Iranian side to hold back a little bit in the north. The Russians clearly don't want a major war to erupt out of Syria and Lebanon between their own partner, Iran, and their own, what are we to them, a rival, I suppose, but not yet an enemy in terms of the Israeli-Russian relationship. So from what I've been able to gather, specifically to do with the north, northern front right now, the Russians are acting as a factor which is trying a little bit to restrain the Iranians. But big strategic picture, I would say, if the world is separating once again, and it may well be into blocks, it's very clear that, you know, of course, Israel is with the American bloc, and it's very clear that the Russians are the main strategic, or one of the main strategic partners and backers of the anti-Western forces in the region, notably Islamic Republic of Iran.
Gentlemen, let's talk now about the day after the war in Gaza. And I've always been struck by Israeli diplomats who come back from Arab countries and say, you know what, they talk about, yeah, but how much money can we make from this? Where's the carrot for this? Where is the incentive for us? Where our interests are served? And obviously, when Jewish people are talking about Israel, they're talking about a faith-based idea about Israel's survival, of unity. We think differently about Israel. Obviously, interests must be served, but they are based upon survival as well as prosperity. And so inviting the UAE and Saudi into rebuilding Gaza is a fantastic route to peace, is it not? Because we all know about Saudi Arabia. By the time 2030 comes along, they'll be hosting the World Cup. Newcastle United will be Premier League champions. They'll have taken over golf. They'll have built NEOM. And they'll allow women to drive more than 70 miles an hour. It's all good, isn't it, that Saudi and normalization with Israel will produce a rebuilt Gaza with a moderate Palestinian leadership, which they underwrite in exchange for all these things. Is that the route to peace?
Wow.
What do you think? That's my route.
Are you asking my vote? Let's do it.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Was that available? That's
I've been doing a show on Talk TV called How to Make Peace in the Middle East. And that's it. That's it.
Let me poke a few holes.
Okay, please.
I don't want to poke any holes. I want that to be the future. Let me poke a few holes.
Yes.
People think in stories. The Palestinian political world has a story about us. And it has, the story has had many versions over many, many generations. But the foundation of the story is that we are dislodgeable. We are removable. We are of a type, and the type changes. Sometimes we're imperialist, sometimes we're colonialist, sometimes we're crusaders, in Hamas's more Islamic language. We are a thing that is, in at its depth, at its core, artificial, and therefore not sustainable, and therefore doomed to fail, and therefore all peace, all acceptance of Israel is a kind of collaboration. It is a violation of the basic faith that there is a just God overseeing a just arc to history, and so it is also an act of heresy. There are different discourses that have different ways of saying that and different extents, and some are secularized and some are much more religious. But nevertheless, that is the story of the Palestinians about us. That is the Palestinian understanding of the ideological elites of the Palestinians that run the factions of Palestinian politics. And therefore, the idea that there is, in some simple sense, a moderate who can take some money from the Saudis and Emiratis and
because we have slightly cleared their way by taking out Hamas's regime in Gaza, can now bring about the prosperity and happiness and joy that everyone hopes for, isn't really how Palestinian society works. It isn't how the Middle East works. It isn't how the story of Israel in the Sunni world, as the Sunni world talks, and the Shia world, as they talk about Israel, actually works. There is no clear post-war moderate leadership. The leadership that tries to ride into Gaza on an Israeli tank will be delegitimized by virtue of it showing up on an Israeli tank. I'm referring also to the Palestinian Authority, which can barely run half of the Palestinian population centers of the West Bank. It has collapsed in many, many places in the West Bank and is sustained in the West Bank essentially by Israeli military power. And every Palestinian knows that, and that's why they're undermined and they're not supported. The basic idea of getting rid of Israel has too much cachet, it's too aspirational, there's too much of a sense of deep religious longing for a return of a renewed Islam that can clear the path forward and give us not a compromised history, but in fact a history that is utterly redeemed from this terrible Jewish thing that happened to us. What the Saudis and Emiratis have been doing, not in the Abraham Accords, but for 20 years, is attempting to push back against a political Islam, against what we call Islamism, against a vision of Islamic renewal that has swept minorities out of the Middle East. Syria's population was 10% Christian 13 years ago, before the Civil War. It is today 2% Christian. What happened to the Christians of Syria, the ancient Christian community of Syria? The world doesn't notice, the world doesn't care, there were no marches in London for them, but in fact they fled the Islamist war, and both sides were Islamist. The Sunni and the Shia of that civil war were profoundly radicalized political Islam. And the minorities in the Middle East it is not a tenable relationship between political Islam and any minority, including the Jews. And what the Saudis and Emiratis have been trying to do for 20 years is push back against that kind of political Islam. For the Saudis, it's a function of 9/11. They have been shutting down madrasas. They have been pushing a different way of thinking about the Muslim world. Long story short, for them, the Abraham Accords is about many different things all at once. There are many layers to it. One simple layer is that they are opposed, that were their arch enemy within the Muslim world for control of the Arab Muslim world, power in the Arab Muslim world is Iran. And to push back against Iran, Israel's a very convenient ally. Unlike the United States, it can't leave the region. But like the United States, it has immense power, it has immense projection power, it has high-tech military and all of those other advantages. So Israel's a very convenient ally against Iran. But there is a piece to normalization with Israel that runs much deeper for them. The Emiratis and the Saudis would like to get over the obsession with Israel, the sense that the destruction of Israel is the beginning of Islamic renewal, that is itself a kind of, in their view, a kind of debasement and of Islam and a statement of Islamic weakness rather than a call for Islam to return out of historic weakness into a position of power as an agent in history, as a major force in history. So there's something deep happening here. They really, really want us to win. It wasn't that the Israelis went to the Saudis and Emiratis and said, please help us in the day after. The Emiratis and the Saudis have leaked themselves the offer to help in Gaza the day after, which is how Emiratis and Saudis say, please finish the job. Please push back against Sunni political Islam in the form of Hamas and clear that spot. Give Iran one of its great losses in the region. Have us able to stand up with you and fix and bring a better day, a better tomorrow, a better horizon for a population of Sunni Muslims that the Muslim world identifies with profoundly. Have us solve a problem that Iran helped create. We will be there to help clean up at the destruction of the war to create that better horizon as part of a broader battle for the soul of Islam in the Arab world. And so I think that there isn't in Palestinian politics a partner. We can't even imagine what it would look like. There's talk among some clever Israelis, and Israelis talking about this I don't think is as important as Palestinians talking about this, and Palestinians at the moment are not talking about this. But there is talk among Israelis about there's a deep civil society in Palestinian society, a kind of large clan system that could produce a local leadership not compromised by the ideologies and the external forces on Hamas and Fatah, etc., that may come into play and could, with the propping up of Saudi and Emirati money and support and Egyptian, I think, power, help become something new that we don't have now in Palestinian politics. So that's the bad news. There is no Palestinian partner. The good news is the Abraham Accord partners, they want us to win. And if we do win, perceptibly win, they want to triple down on the alliance. Because for them, it is about Iran. It's also about Islam and Islam's own renewal and a better future for the Muslim world as a whole. And so I am very optimistic. I am very pessimistic in the narrow confines of Palestinian politics, very optimistic in the regional sense.
Optimistic?
Yeah, no, I'd largely agree with that. I mean, a couple of points to add to the picture. I mean, with regard to the Gulf people, Mohammed bin Zayed, of course, in Crown Prince in the United Arab Emirates and MBS, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. There's some additional, I think, motivations to this. First of all, with regard to the United Arab Emirates, it's very notable, and I've noted this in my own conversations over the years with Emiratis, that they have the same list of enemies as Israel, but they don't list them in the same order. Of course, with Israel, as is well known, and correctly, from Israel's point of view, the number one enemy is Iran, and the number two enemy or three is Sunni political Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Salafis, the ISIS. The Emiratis and MBZ specifically calibrated a little bit differently. As far as they are concerned, again and again and again, this comes up in conversation, the main challenge is Sunni political Islam, and the main personification of that for them is the Muslim Brotherhood. They regard the Muslim Brotherhood correctly, again, from their point of view, since they are themselves a Sunni Muslim country, and therefore they have a domestic concern about potentially about the Brotherhood that Israel doesn't have to consider. For them, the Muslim Brothers were the main enemy. They successfully, and MBZ's historical role in this, I think, will eventually become clear. They successfully turned back the advance of the Muslim Brotherhood in this region over the last decade. What was called wrongly the Arab Spring was, in fact, to a great extent, the advance of the Muslim Brothers in a number of different societies. And the Emiratis were deeply involved, it now appears, in the key historic moment in which that advance was stopped, which was the military coup in July 2013 in Egypt. That was the moment at which the Brothers' advance stopped and their retreat began. So I think one of the motivations also to partner with Israel is the sense of Israel being a powerful ally in that key struggle from the Emirati point of view, which of course means that, yeah, Hamas in Gaza can be a good episode for us in that story on condition that we win. We have to win conclusively, and the Emiratis have to see that we have won conclusively, and then everything else becomes possible. The commerce and the diplomacy and the rest of it is all, in any case, a little bit there and can be much more there on condition that we win. With regard to Mohammed bin Salman, let us not forget the issue is also economic. Mohammed bin Salman, with his Vision 2030, understands that Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has to, within a limited amount of time, move beyond a petrochemicals-based economy or go down. He doesn't have infinite time for that. He has to build a new Saudi Arabia capable of bringing in income, not dependent on petrochemicals. Israel can be an important part of that too. That's the way he sees it. So that's a big motivating factor for the Saudis as well. Yes, I think if we can manage to deliver, and it still is an if, of course, but if we can manage to deliver in the amount of time remaining to us, that death blow to the Hamas political authority in Gaza. Again, not to the Hamas idea. No, that's out there. You can't kill an idea, but that's okay. We're trying to destroy a political authority, and that is doable by military power. And there are examples of it in recent history. If we can do that, then yes, we certainly will have the Gulfies on our side in terms of what happens next. And I suspect that one way or another, it'll be an arrangement, including Gulf finance. I suspect also including the Ramallah Palestinian Authority in some form or another. And I sincerely hope also including a local leadership. How exactly we'll get to that, what exactly we'll look like, we don't know yet. And I think nobody can say. But it all ultimately still does depend on us achieving the military goal against Hamas in the available time remaining to make all that other stuff possible, in my estimation.
And just to add to that, also, let's talk about the West. I've had conversations with certain anti-Israel thinkers, ideologues, sometimes yelling at me. My message to them is very simple. As long as Hamas runs politics in Palestine, as long as Hamas is
the preeminent and most popular and most influential political faction in the Palestinian political space, then all of the pressure campaigns everywhere in the world, the people screaming in London to pressure Israel against me, are in fact, they don't realize it because they're profoundly ignorant, but they are in fact competing with Hamas. There is this arena that is inside the Israeli psyche, inside my head, and in that arena, the international left or pro-Palestinian campaign says to me, if you don't do what we want, which is, let's imagine that it's pull out of the West Bank. Many of them have other demands, or pull out of Tel Aviv as well, but let's imagine that it's pull out of the West Bank. If you don't pull out of the West Bank, I'm going to scream at you, boycott you, ostracize you, sanction you, I'm going to be very mean to you. And then Hamas says to me on the other side of that conversation that they're having in my head without realizing it, anywhere you pull out of, I'm going to murder your children from that place. So, you know, please pull out. I really am going to need this space. It's hard to murder your children from Gaza if you live, you know, in Tel Aviv. And they don't understand that they're competing with each other. And so I'm saying this cartoonishly, but I think that it is actually not a cartoonish point. If Hamas is out of the picture, huge opportunities open up with the Emiratis, with the Saudis, exactly as Jonathan said very, very well, for their interests, for our interests, but also for a larger sort of deeper culture war for what Islam is today, political Islam especially. But also the international community can then come to Israel. If there isn't this thing called Hamas in Gaza, if there isn't, the blockade begins in 2007 with Hamas's takeover, it doesn't begin in 2005 with Israel's withdrawal. If there isn't Hamas in Gaza, what excuses my blockade? If there isn't Hamas as the preeminent impulse, narrative in Palestinian politics, what excuses some significant portion of the military rule in the West Bank or of the things that limit Palestinian lives in the West Bank? And so it is shocking to me that the campaign against Israel right now doesn't realize this. I mean, it's not shocking to me because I don't think it's really about the well-being of Palestinians or they would be an anti-Hamas campaign. But they're literally competing with Hamas in my head for what I should do. And so there is nothing that the international community can do for Palestinians that Hamas will not undo. And so we are doing a great service to the international community. And I desperately wish it was a lower civilian death toll. I don't get to decide that. Hamas gets to decide that. You want to come to me and talk to me about a specific bomb? I'm happy to complain about my army. I don't think Israel's perfect in anything. It's a country. I don't think America's perfect. I apologize. I'm in London being hosted by wonderful British people, but I don't even think the UK is perfect.
What?
But nevertheless, I will by removing Hamas, clear a path for that international discourse to actually influence me for the first time in many, many years. And so on every front that you could imagine a better future for Palestinians, as we are told to think of what a better future looks like for Palestinians, this has to be accomplished and this has to be completed.
I've done 128 episodes of Johnny Gould's Jewish State, and that was one of the highest level discussions I think I've ever had. I learn so much on this odyssey, and I've added meat to the bone of everything I understand. Chaviv Retig Gur, Jonathan Speier, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you so much. Very much.
Fantastic, thank you.
Wait, who's better? One and on record.
I'm going to stop the tape now and say...
No, you don't.
And say... There's a lot of competing attention for you, I do know. You're probably consuming more media than ever before to be right up to speed with what's going on in Israel and back home. I'm playing my part in the best way I can, using my journalistic and production skills to make the case for Israel via this, Johnny Gould's Jewish State, and I've done it since 2018. If you enjoy my podcast... and you'd rather it existed than not, that I kept doing it, you can support me very simply by buying me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Johnny Gould, because it really helps. Tell your friends, subscribe now if you haven't already, scroll back and look through the 120 previous episodes. And as always, thank you for listening.